Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's a rebel with a cause. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And we're also joined, excitingly, by a new guest, the first guest of the Boris Johnson era, possibly the last, because it's probably not going to be a very long era, let's be honest, listeners. We are joined by campaigner for Birmingham Friends of the Earth, Shaz Rahman. Hello, Shaz.
Thank you for having me.
We first met Shaz during the AV campaign, and we learnt together how not to win elections.
Many, many elections ever since.
So many elections. Very excitingly, we have a podcast about events in the news which aren't Brexit related.
It's shocking, really, isn't it?
It is the first time, maybe in years, it could even be the first time since Trump won in 2016. So we haven't had a news podcast that isn't Brexit related.
So grab your stopwatches and see exactly how long it takes us until we actually end up mentioning Brexit anyway.
So we're going to talk about the Twitter spat between Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy. Let's save that for the football podcast next week. Instead, what we're going to talk about is Extinction Rebellion. We're going to talk about protests, and we're going to talk about climate change in 2019. So Extinction Rebellion, they have launched a new wave of strikes this week. There were some in April. New ones started on October the 7th. And they are blocking various sites in central London and across the country with various non-violent direct action. There's been lots of yoga, which I saw.
I'd not seen protest yoga, no.
So there's yoga with bagpipes in the background. There were lots of interpretive dance.
I did see the interpretive dance.
There was an octopus that was kettled by various police officers. Well, it's a group of environmental activists, I suppose, who've done research into the effective ways of protesting. And they've decided that the best way of trying to protest and make a message heard is through this kind of non-violent direct action.
Yeah, so a quick point on that. They're trying to turn it into a bit of a festival atmosphere to try and get more people to join them. Well, it sounds a bit funny to have yoga at a protest. There is a serious point to it. It's whether you think that it distracts from the message itself.
Yeah, I think there's also a bit of an element of how seriously those kind of techniques actually do lend to your message overall. Because I'd seen the octopus, and the octopus I'm down with as a protest method. I've also seen the interpretive dance, which was done in front of some police officers and things. That one I looked at and went, this doesn't help at all. But I imagine if I'd seen the yoga, then I might be having a similar kind of reaction to that as well.
It feels like it stops being processed at a point, and then you're having a nice day out. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, you can look either way. But what it does mean, though, is that we've started off talking about something slightly different than what we were meant to. We were talking about the image rather than what the science is.
When we're talking about the techniques that they're trying to utilise, I think an awful lot of it may very well be kind of linked to the notion of, like, how can we get things spread digitally? Effectively almost trying to go for that meme-oriented approach, because these sorts of things are going to be spread virally, both by people who approve and by people who think, oh, this is ridiculous. But either way, the knowledge of the Extinction Rebellion is getting out there, and what they stand for kind of becomes more newsworthy as a result of that as well.
Especially with an issue like climate change, which it's hard. It's maybe a way of trying to put climate change on the front pages in a way that few of the protests have been able to.
On Question Time this week, they had a representative from Extinction Rebellion, and 2 years ago, that would have been unheard of. Even having somebody talk about Extinction Rebellion as a serious entity would have been unheard of 2 years ago. So when I watched Question Time a year ago, people were talking about climate change as if it's now a thing, as in this is the science. When I used to watch climate change 5 years ago, you'd also have the dissenting voice saying, oh, do we really have to take it that seriously? Are you sure about the science? Whereas now, on this week's Question Time, there was nobody saying this is definitely not real. Everybody, even, what's her name, Julie
Hartley Brewer.
She was on there. She wasn't denying climate change. She was just saying a response needed was different to what Extinction Rebellion was. So she was talking about technological saviours rather than, you know, changing what we use or using less, flying less, lots of the fossil fuel companies. She wasn't talking about those things. She was saying, you know, we'll have electric cars and that'll be the end of the day.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of shift, isn't it? Like somehow magic will save us, I suppose. All these solutions, which actually we already have. It's just, I suppose the point of Extinction Rebellion is we have the solutions already. We just don't have the political will. And what I find interesting about the protests is, kind of reminds me of a few of the opposition protests in some authoritarian regimes, actually. So I was reading a book recently called The Dictator's Learning Curve by William Dobson, and he goes into a few different non-violent protests in regimes like, say, Serbia, Venezuela, and Egypt, when Mubarak was in charge before the Arab Spring. And he gives a couple of examples. One of them is when Chavez tried to put forward a referendum in Venezuela, changing the constitution. I think one of the things was abolishing the idea of fixed terms, so essentially Chavez could be president for life. And one of the big groups in opposition to this were the Venezuelan students. A bit like Extinction Rebellion, tried to keep their protest quite lighthearted. So they would blockade a few streets, and you could get through their blockade if you could tell them one aspect of the constitution that Chavez was trying to change. Also, I think a familiar smear that the Chavez government would say about the students was that they were in the pay of the CIA and the American government. So the students then would do protests outside the banks saying the banks aren't paying us the money from the CIA on time, what's going on? So trying to make light of the situation. Also mentions Slobodan Milosevic, his wife was known for wearing kind of white floral things in her hair. The non-violent protesters in Serbia, they put these kind of same floral arrangements on turkeys. Got loads of turkeys, put the flowers on the heads and just let the turkeys free. At which point the Serbian police have a problem, which is, do they do nothing and let the turkeys roam free? Or do they try and apprehend the turkey and then the police are ridiculous chasing after a turkey? And I thought of that this week when I saw, I don't know if you've seen it as well, listeners on Twitter, but the where you've got the police officers trying to kettle this massive pink octopus made me think about that. And essentially what the protesters, and the William Dobson interviews one of the protesters and says, well, if you try and take on Mike Tyson in a boxing match, you're going to fail. You know, if you try and take on an authoritarian government like Chavez in a violent way, you're going to come a cropper. Whereas actually, if you try and play a chess match with Mike Tyson, you try and change the terms of debate, you might get somewhere. And that's kind of what I think Extinction Rebellion are trying to do. They're trying to change the dialogue a little bit and almost trying to withhold consent from the political system, essentially because they see, at the moment, the political system, as they see it, is not allowing space to talk about climate change and these kind of issues. And they kind of have a point, don't they?
Yeah. So, whilst the tone has changed in the past couple of years, the acceptance is there. Extraction for fossil fuel industries is not decreasing anytime soon. Is it Aramco, the Saudi state, that they're producing more barrels of oil than ever? And whilst the Saudi government's saying nice things about solar panels and having deserts covered in solar panels, there's been little evidence of that really happening on a large scale. When we look at the overall picture, the number one thing we can do as a world is reduce fossil fuel extraction. Even our own country, we're trying to introduce fracking, which is better than coal in terms of carbon emissions, but still we're just drilling further and further and not actually addressing the root cause of what we need to be doing.
There's definitely kind of a gap between the kind of like the growth in acceptance of the need to do something in regards to climate change versus the political reality and the political will to do it. And it's one of those interesting little things where, as much as the Extinction Rebellion is very good at getting people talking about climate change and all of that, it will be interesting to see how they try and translate that into something more, I'm just trying to think what the word is here, more substantial in terms of an actual outcome, an increase in awareness for climate change and it becoming more an accepted view that we need to do something is all well and good, but how do we translate that into, you know, a policy agenda? That, I think, is almost like the next logical step that those sorts of groups need to come through with.
Yeah, so even on a very local level, in Birmingham, we have lots of 1960s road infrastructure and a piece of land in Perry Bar is proving very controversial at the moment. We have a flyover to basically allow you to bypass Perry Bar if you're in a car, and that's been planned to be knocked down by the council. And there are lots of protests and people have been very angry about this. But if you do want to redesign our cities for a future where we can sustainably live. Things like flyovers, which prioritises cars over public transport or walking and cycling. These things have to change. It's very hard to go from an individual thinking, oh yes, climate justice is a good thing, or reducing is a good thing, then making that to an actual policy decision which could then affect their lives.
And it's particularly hard, I think, in a place like Birmingham, obscure Birmingham reference here, listeners, but Birmingham, a city in the 60s which did bet very heavily on the car, and we are 10 minutes walk away from the Pershore Road, which used to have a tram system from the centre of Birmingham into the Lickey Hills, into the edge of Worcester, I suppose.
Worcestershire,
I should say. Not the end of Worcester. That would be a very long tram line. But that, again, was ripped up in the 1920s, 1930s. If we don't do anything in 10 or 15 years' time, the city centre will be gridlocked.
Quite literally today, I was getting my hair cut in the barbers, and next to me there was somebody complaining about basically a load of the city centre infrastructure and things like that, where currently, again, obscure Birmingham references, Broad Street, which is the main kind of like nightclub street in Birmingham.
Imagine paradise of wine bars, very relaxed Mediterranean atmosphere, the odd ambulance.
And then go to the exact opposite of it. So Broad Street is currently closed off for traffic due to them building a tram system, which will go from, I think, basically New Street Station up towards Five Ways and into Edgbaston. On top of that, you've also got Birmingham City Council are introducing like a clean air zone in the city centre.
Well, the government is forcing councils to introduce a clean air zone, and therefore the Conservative government and the Tory... I'm just going to make a party political point here for a second, where Birmingham Conservatives are basically blaming the council for something the government's making them do. Sorry, Chaz.
Yeah, so credit to Birmingham City Council, because of the ones that are being forced to do some impact measures, Birmingham City Council is one of the very few to actually introduce a clean air zone. Other councils have just said, oh, we'll tinker at the edges and that will be enough, whereas Birmingham City Council has actually had the bravery, because it's a very controversial measure, to introduce a clean air zone, which is different from a congestion charge.
Yes. But Steve, you were getting your hair cut. I do envy you.
But yeah, and the guy next to me was complaining about the fact that Broad Street had been closed off because it was affecting the businesses on there, which is understandable why people, like, especially the owners and the people who work in those businesses, would be concerned about that. They were saying, oh, we don't need the tram. It's like, well, no, we do, mate. He then spent about 10 minutes or so complaining about the clean air zone and the costs it might have for him and his employees who work in the city centre. And he just seemed to completely miss the fact that they just don't drive in to work. They get the train, or they get the bus, or that tram that you've just been complaining about. They can get that potentially in as well, depending on where they're coming from. There's definitely work that needs to be done in kind of making individuals aware about what the actual meaningful solutions are. And for the short term, that might mean a little bit of inconvenience, but it's going to be inconvenience that actually is going to be beneficial for everybody in the long term. And not just in terms of climate change, but in terms of just making it easier for people to get in and out of like Birmingham city centre.
And also, we struggle to make a positive case for this, but if you've got a path you can walk down and you've got lots of nice trees and you've got a nice bus system that gets you out quickly, that's a much nicer environment to be in than where you've got gridlock cars, mm-hmm. exhaust pipes in your face, air pollution levels which are at a dangerous level defined by the EU. And if you live on the Pershore Road, it's probably like smoking 20 a day. The science has been telling us for years, but it's only now that we're actually almost paying attention to it.
Well, yes, that's... I feel so much better about my walk back down from the Pershore Road after door knocking today. it's already affecting Steve. He's already... It's another respiratory problem. And when you talk about workable solutions, Steve, I think part of the issue is when you have issues, say, like a carbon tax or extra tax on petrol and what have you, that ends up punishing these individuals and these individual businesses. And you can kind of see that, I suppose, in maybe episodes meant to be on kind of climate protest this year as well. Look at some of the Yellow Jackets in France, whose original inspiration was against a carbon tax and a petrol tax in the centre of France. That if you end up just taxing things more rather than putting in extra solutions like public transport, essentially just shift the costs onto to the poorest in society who can't pay for it anyway, while the more affluent and the bigger companies who are responsible for the vast majority of carbon emissions can still pay that tax and get off scot-free.
And it's hard to make that case to people, because what we're going to do with the clean air zone is we're going to make it nicer for people to breathe, and we're going to use the money from that to actually fund the public transport infrastructure. But that public transport infrastructure might be not ready for 10 years, right? So if you're living in that and you've got roadworks everywhere and it's all gridlock because people don't know where to drive anymore because they're trying to avoid the edge of the clean air zone, and it's like that for 6 months, that isn't really helpful for you in the short term, but longer term, it will make things much better.
I almost take your point about Extinction Rebellion not having workable solutions, Steve, but isn't it a little bit like if we said to the suffragettes, but what voting system do you want women to have?
I didn't mean to imply that, they don't have workable solutions and then, you know, we shouldn't take them seriously. I think my point was more along the lines of, as a whole, like the environmental movement needs to work out how they can turn this, you know, vague support for doing something about climate change and turn that into support for something specific. I'm not saying they need to turn around and produce, like, you know, a manifesto of action that the British government or international governments need to do. Because actually, we know what needs to be done. The most of the policy work probably already exists on this, but it's maybe drawing, you know, how they can turn what they're already doing to a couple of key policy points that people can then start talking about.
I am interested in the tactics that they're using, partly because, as you say, it's kind of bringing climate change to the headlines, which is quite a hard thing to do. But I think also it is a very different way of organising from, say, something like Occupy. Because Occupy Wall Street, and even there was Occupy London, I think, probably about 10, 11 years ago, was very big, very clunky, very kind of citizen assembly led. Whereas this is... The interesting thing I think about Extinction Rebellion is it's led by people who've obviously done their research into what they think makes effective protest in terms of even like effective management systems as well. And so it's not a very top-down organisation. Everything is led by circles, is what they're called. So there are events happening all over the country which are done by various activists in local regions that the big steering group don't necessarily have a lot of control over. And that method of organising, I think, is very, very interesting.
It's also very risky. All it takes is one incident where an Extinction Rebellion process does something really seriously wrong, and everyone gets tainted with the same brush. Say there's a serious incident involving violence, like actual violence. So it's not to say you need to have a top-down approach, but you need to have a coordinated approach where everyone knows what they're doing and actually knows the risks. So one of the problems with Extinction Rebellion at the moment is that we're talking about the yoga, talking about the dancing, is that this is a serious thing people are doing, and there are potential consequences. If you get arrested whilst you are protesting and you get a criminal record, there's a chance that lots of jobs out there in the future will be closed off to you. You probably won't be able to become a teacher, local government, those kind of things probably will be closed to you. And as part of Young Friends of the Earth, I've been in the building because Extinction Rebellion do some of their training stuff in the West Midlands in Young Friends of the Earth building, and I've listened in, and they're role-playing how to chain themselves to a building, for example. And it's really important and it's really good what they're doing, but I sometimes get a sense that they're not understanding the importance of the consequences that could happen. So if they get arrested, what would they do? When you get campaigners that have been in direct action for years, they will know their law, they'll know how to read their rights, they'll know what to say to a police officer. Because this movement has exploded almost out of nowhere, it looks like. We haven't got the infrastructure yet to support these people who are doing things that I think are very important, but we need to help them more. As in, if you're going to go do something that's brave or reckless, how do you help yourself when things go wrong?
One criticism I've seen of the protesters is essentially that the Extinction Rebellion protesters are quite middle class. My slight rejoinder to that would be, most political movements probably have a middle class white leadership. Certainly that's most Labour leaders have been from a white middle class background, originally people like Keir Hardie. Bit of a middle class attitudes as well in terms of things like temperance, not really shared by a lot of working class Labour members and a lot of the working class generally. And it's generally just how political movements start. I don't think it's necessarily a criticism of these people that they're middle class. I think it's just you have to start from somewhere. But as you say, what you don't want is maybe people getting involved who don't understand the consequences. And actually, my impression of Extinction Rebellion is, if you don't want to get arrested, because certainly as someone who works in education, I wouldn't want to get arrested because that would mean I couldn't have my job, that there are avenues in terms of art and crafts and other ways that you can support the movement without getting arrested necessarily.
Yes. one of the jobs for Extinction Rebellion is to make it more inclusive then. So if I'm from a VME background, and yeah, I'm very aware that if I was going to put myself at risk of being arrested, I'm likely to be treated differently. So I get trains to Europe quite often, and if I'm going there and going through Eurostar on the way back into London, and I'm with a group of people who are white, I will get stopped. If I'm not, I'll get stopped. And there's the slight things that lots of these campaigners won't consider when they're doing these things, that if you are from a different background or you have a disability, your lived experiences of even very subtle things are very different, and so the way you perceive them will be different. And so I'm not saying that it's not the fault of middle-class protesters, but as a movement, the people who are likely to be affected worst by climate change are those that are able to deal with it least. Mm. And so as a movement, everybody needs to be able to figure out how to help everybody. So if you're a middle-class protester, don't feel guilty about being a middle-class protester. Just try and be aware of how you can help be more inclusive.
And another criticism that seems to have come across from a lot of, it's generally just a lot of the kind of right-wing journalists on Twitter, people that we've mentioned, Julia Hartley Brewer, people like Toby Young as well, is this idea that essentially their protest is invalidated because they've gone shopping and eating sandwiches from Pret-a-Manger or McDonald's. Pret-a-Manger has been quite a big part of the culture war recently, which has been interesting to behold.
Yeah, what was it? Who was it? Was it Rory Stewart?
Who got
criticised because he basically said, I don't drink, so I don't have a local pub. I'd rather be in, you're more likely to find me in a Pret-a-Manger.
It is, but he should know that the best local pub in London is the Harp. But go on.
The general point about just, oh yeah, these people are participating in society that which has aspects that they disapprove of, therefore we can ignore everything they say, is just absolutely farcical. If you hold to that, then you can't make an argument for change of anything in society. At all, and that would include things that they'd be in favour of as well.
I do agree with you to a point, but it's up to you to educate yourself as to why you're doing this. If you don't know why you're doing this and the effect of your actions, then you're going to end up doing things like go to McDonald's when the beef industry is culpable for a very large amount of our carbon emissions. And so what you could do is you could go to McDonald's and get their veggie wrap. I mean, whilst you're not changing the system as much as going to a local independent cafe, but you are still subverting the system. The more people that buy the veggie wrap from McDonald's, the more people will then say, okay, maybe this is a good product, the more stock of veggie wraps there will be. But yeah, it's very, very difficult to be consistent. Everyone's a hypocrite, and Everybody should try their best, but you shouldn't beat yourself up if you can't be consistent. And that's one of the things that, as a campaigner who's spent many years with Friends of the Earth, we often sit in a pub and we go, ah, I drove here today, or I did this, and then it's like, we do what we can, but you can't get lost in the really minute detail. We all do what we can, we all do good things, and if you beat yourself up over everything, then you'll just end up crying in the pub non-stop.
Yeah, and there's also just the fact, again, going back to that inclusivity argument, that an awful lot of people, just they're not going to be able to afford to do everything that they would want to do to live their ideals, just because, you know, if you disagree with pesticides and all of that sort of stuff, organic food costs more. Maybe you're not in a position to be able to afford that. Certainly, in the left, if you get into this kind of purity trap, which, to be honest, I think most of these critiques have been coming from the right and are disingenuous rather than it being something that the left is battling with.
Well, I think it's a slightly different criticism from the right, because with the right it's all about personal responsibility, and they assume that almost if everyone they don't seem to like the hypocrisy of it, and I think it's almost this: if everyone had the veggie wrap, then it would be okay, and actually it wouldn't be okay. The problem is they are protesting the systemic problems, and the right is consciously ignoring that, I think, to try and make a smart ass point as well. Like, the problem is the fossil fuel companies and the fact that our public transport system is screwed. And also, as you say, Shaz, like, people are hypocrites, and people are going to do the easy option just because that's what people are like. And therefore, it's the job of our political system and governments to make it easier for people, not to criticise people who are trying to make a difference.
So a really interesting question is, with Extinction Rebellion, if you look at a chart, like a scale, they're on one end of the scale as to how a political campaign would work, tying themselves to stuff. They're trying to disrupt the city. When we talk about the suffragettes, we talk about civil rights with America in the 1960s. They are now seen as heroes. They were on the right side of history. That's what Extinction Rebellion wants to be seen as in the future. But then if you look at the scale, there's a whole list of things in the middle and towards the other end. So as part of Burger Friends the Earth, what we do there is we do lots of policy work. We write reports about we should have a food collection rather than, you know, chucking stuff into either a landfill or an incinerator. We lobby our councillors. We do lots of stuff that is important and does have an effect, but is not very visible. So, you know, me going on a psychopath and taking photos of that before you got a blog, whilst has a use, is nowhere near as visible as me if I went and tied myself to a 4x4, and then lots of people will see what I'm doing. But so the more extreme you go, the more you are likely to get people looking at you, but you are more likely then to turn those people away. So Extinction Rebellion has found a way to get more eyeballs on their campaign, but is that the right way to go?
For what they're trying to achieve at the moment, it absolutely is the right way to go, just because they're basically at the let's build awareness of the issue stage of the campaign. I mean, I'm thinking of this almost like a marketing campaign now, where so they're trying to build brand awareness of themselves, of the issue, and then at a later point, you try and convert that into something else. And so what they've been doing, I think, works quite nicely for that, because they've identified the most successful things. What they've basically done is they've narrowed themselves down to an issue. Whilst what they're campaigning for, broadly speaking, is broad systemic change, they're presenting it as a single issue, climate change. They're being dynamic. They're not just parking themselves somewhere. They're doing lots of things all over the place, so that there's always pretty much seemingly a discussion point that can happen with them. They're not just putting themselves in St. Paul's Square and staying there for 6 months, which people get bored of reading about. Where they are doing areas where maybe people are going to be put off by it, they are also counterbalancing that with that kind of festival of fun type atmosphere. As much as I found the dance off, the interpretive dance between the one guy and the police slightly cringeworthy online, it doesn't make me want to get involved, but it doesn't put me off them either. I think it's not like they're, for the most part, stopping things from happening that are actually people are going to get annoyed at. There might have been one or two instances of some protesters kind of like trying to do some stuff outside of hospitals, which is a bit kind of don't go down that road. But broadly speaking, they're not doing anything that is actually harmful to anybody in any way. It's an inconvenience, and as long as it remains an inconvenience and not actually doing anybody any harm, I think they're probably in the right kind of area at the moment.
Yeah, that's a good point, because they're not at the extreme end of the scale. You know what Peter did back in the day with the animal rights movement?
Yeah.
They were extremely divisive. Like, even their cause wasn't uniformly accepted. Whereas Extinction Rebellion's cause is almost universally accepted, so they don't feel the need to go around, you know, throwing paint over people and, in some cases, like sabotaging, doing illegal activities that would actually have consequences for the people they were doing these activities to.
Yeah, it's very much the emphasis on the non-violent action protest. And I think, I mean, you mentioned the point about maybe access to hospitals and things being involved. My impression is that often they will try and pick at roads that are often cordoned off already. So, for instance, the route of the London Marathon, for instance, they will protest because then they'll try and blockade that road because police already have a system in place for if that road is blocked off through the London Marathon. So, obviously, these tend to be main roads where ambulances may be going through, which I think is why you end up with those kind of stories. And I think that it's all about having that environmental movement, and you need both, I think, is the upshot, isn't it? You need people who are going to do the policy details, who are going to lobby elected councillors and say, you should do it in this way. But then you also need people highlighting the issue, because the councillor doesn't necessarily have an electoral incentive to do anything about it unless they've got constituents that know that there's a big environmental issue that the council can act upon as well.
And the constituents are putting pressure on that council or MP to actually make change happen.
Yeah. Maybe the final point we could talk about is I was interested with what people think about the police response, because you always get a few people saying, well, the police are just going and beating them up or something. But it was an interesting Irish Times article on the differences between the Irish police approach and the UK police approach, where certainly the Irish Times printed it, and obviously we're now at war with Ireland over the border, so you know, they were basically a hostile power.
Oh, we got to Brexit in the end.
The way that the Irish Times painted it anyway was that the Irish police, it was very much a case of laughing, joking, very laid-back atmosphere with the protesters, whereas the UK police, lots of preemptive arrests that happened. I think there were about 1,000 people arrested preemptively before the protests. I wondered if you had anyone had any thoughts on police treatment?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few other kind of things I've seen online with this, almost actually which is from the UK side of things, almost the kind of like the opposite of what you've just described, is that after some of the protests, some of the protesters sent thank you notes and things to the police to basically say thank you ever so much for actually basically not being idiots and treating us all right and treating us well when we were inside. You've got those videos of like a 91-year-old guy being escorted by the police away, and everybody basically being very respectful and helping him around and things like that as well.
So something that's different in this sense of protest than some of the others that we talked about is that the people who are going to protest are planning to get arrested. They're going there in a non-violent way to disrupt the system, and they know if they get arrested, that will disrupt the system. It doesn't have to be violence. It doesn't have to mean that the police look angry or the police have to brutalise anybody. If they are then put into a jail for 24 hours or however long it is, that will give the police a massive inconvenience. And as long as it's respectful on both sides, you're still getting your message across and you're still hopefully achieving your aims.
I think we should end it there. We've got some disrupting of the system ourselves to do. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. You can follow us on Twitter at nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. We'll have an episode out in a week, and then we'll have one again out next Sunday. I'm on Twitter at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
At Shaz Robin Fertie.
Happy plotting, everyone.